So Sanditon. If we studied Jane Austen at school, we were encouraged to think of her as the mistress of polished perfection, her poise, symmetry, and sense of proportion a matter of style and substance, or rather of substance as style. This is the mark of her genius. Everything came finished from her pen, wrote her admiring brother Henry in his 1818 biographical notice. Perfection is a label that has stuck to Austen over the centuries. We can think of her as nothing less than an angel writing novels with a quill plucked from one of her own wings, commented a little acidly the reviewer in the English Woman's Domestic Magazine in 1866. For Oxford Don Mary Lassells, writing the first major critical study in 1939, one could almost be content to claim no more for Austen than delicate precision. While for Berkeley professor D.A. Miller in 2003, such thrillingly inhuman utterance was not stylish, it was style itself. How then to find a place for Sanditon, that raw, unfinished, indeed barely begun fragment? Our World's Classics edition, published in July this year, marks only the second time OUP has issued the work as a standalone text. The first time was almost 100 years ago in 1925 and under very different circumstances. At that time, the great Austen editor, R.W. Chapman, who was also secretary to the delegates here, produced the first transcription of the manuscript, entitling it Fragment of a Novel. He did so in the interests of scholarly completeness and not because he thought it was a lost masterpiece. Before that, the work was essentially unknown to the public. Left in manuscript at Austen's death in 1817, it had been summarised in her nephew's Memoir of Jane Austen in 1871, where its 120 manuscript chapters, sorry, manuscript pages, getting carried away myself, turning it into War and Peace here, where its 120 manuscript pages are reduced to only 12 printed pages of selective quotation and plot. Significantly, Sanditon's publication in 1925, over 100 years after it was written, was attended with embarrassment. As late as 1948, Chapman expressed his concern that it is unworthy of a place in the Austen canon. Its satire too harsh, its style too crude. If she had lived, he confided, she would have smoothed these coarse strokes. The early curators of her legacy of perfection held symmetry and proportion in high esteem. To their minds, there was something unseemly in Sanditon. Since 1925, OUP has continued to package Sanditon inside Minor Works, volume 6 of Chapman's standard edition of Austen's novels, first issued in 1954. It's also been bundled since 1980 together with two other short manuscript tales, Lady Susan and the Watsons, as makeweights inside the World's Classics edition of Northanger Abbey. Where Minor Works provided a label under which to group everything Austen left in manuscript at her death, the classification with Northanger Abbey is more difficult to tease out. Possibly, we might argue, these are all works that Austen herself struggled to place. We know that Northanger Abbey was both the first manuscript sold in 1803 and part of her final posthumous publication in 1818. But specific connections between the two, between Sanditon and Northanger Abbey, are pretty hard to find. What we can say with certainty is that it's a bold move to issue Sanditon as a standalone text, as a text to celebrate rather than to excuse. It's a bold move because it's very short, only 11 and a half chapters, around 24,000 words, roughly one-fifth of a finished Austen novel. There are, in our new World's Classics edition, 70 pages of text and 44 pages of apparatus. Published alone, the work stands proud in its own space, in full focus. Critical apparatus, production values, marketing are all centred on it. In this new edition, Sanditon is no longer the appendix, it's now the main event. Publishing it on its own, allowing it to stand its own ground, invites new questions about Austen's art. It offers a statement that we're looking to deliver a new Jane Austen. The old Jane Austen was the heir of Samuel Johnson's elegant, antithetical prose, a writer whose sensibilities were Augustan and pre-romantic. The new Jane Austen is a fragment artist with more in common than we have allowed with her romantic contemporaries, with Coleridge, who wrote Kubla Khan, and Keats, who wrote Hyperion, those great fragment poems. Romanticism set writing to work in a different mode, and the fragment is considered its most distinctive expression, the sign of its originality. Sanditon is one of the finest examples of romantic fragment art, because it is shot through with fragmentation at every level, stylistic and structural. Unfinished, in some ways barely begun, it's also available as a fully readable structure whose fragment characteristics are thematic as well as formal. Sanditon is a study in fragments of a society in fragments. In Sanditon, Austen offers a vision of England in her present moment of writing, 1817, in the immediate aftermath of more than 20 years of European war. She describes a world opening up to change after decades of confinement. It's a time of economic instability, of speculation, of motiveless activity, and sheer recklessness after decades of restraint. Mr. Parker, who abandons his family estate and its attendant responsibilities to invest in the new leisure industry, is a type of modern man, dislocated by recent events and wishing to make the world anew. We first meet him as he scrambles out of an overturned carriage, the accident a consequence of his ridiculous misjudgment that the road he travels, no more than a rough lane, leads somewhere. The road is a dead end, the carriage accident, a little morality play encompassed in the work's opening page, anticipates everything that follows. The appropriateness of the fragment's unfinished state to its subject matter of misinformation and wrong turns, of risk exposed, is irresistible. In his optimistic way, Mr. Parker is laying waste, breaking up the old order, tearing up one kind of agreement between landowner and local community, and negotiating new private contracts. The fragment form enacts the jeopardy and vanity of his half-built schemes. But not just those of Mr. Parker. In Sanditon, communication and narrative organisation alike break down under the obsessive energies of a range of idiosyncratic projectors, each trapped within their own new-built schemes, bizarre thought bubbles and unique obsessions. There's the meddlesome do-gooder, Diana Parker, whose benevolence is a form of crazed bullying. The lady killer, Sir Edward Denham, whose hyperbolic ravings despoil vast swathes of contemporary literature. These characters don't converse with one another, they rant in monologue, adrift from their interlocutors. The non-eccentric heroine, Charlotte Heywood, walks through their mad worlds as a visitor at an exhibition, examining a cabinet of curiosities. This is startlingly new, startlingly modern. Sanditon's fragmentariness is utterly appropriate as a comment on this post-war society, made up, Austen suggests, of self-regarding egotists and fantasists, people who've lost their moorings. A conspiracy between dissociated style and subject matter appears to have willed the work into being as a designed fragment. In Sanditon, Austen questions everything we think of as Austenian. She abandons her organising trope of the village. Three or four families in a country village is the very thing to work on. It is the delight of my life, she had informed her niece Anna in 1814. The Austen village has been culturally ingested over the last 200 years, from Tunbridge Wells to Texas, from Cheltenham to China, as a vision of England, England as immemorial village. Now in Sanditon, Austen ditches the village, and with no great subtlety. What the narrator calls the real village of Sanditon lies behind the main action, which is conducted in the new-built houses set apart marching perilously close to the cliff edge. Here, writes the narrator, at this cliff edge, the modern began. What else does Austin abandon? The social dynamic of the village has gone, with its mutual obligations and routines thrown into confusion by the arrival of a stranger or two. In Sanditon, everyone is a stranger to everyone else. Strangers outnumber locals. The heroine, too, is an outsider. There are no comforting certainties. Everything is as changeful as the tides. No longer landlocked, we're all adrift by the sea. This wasn't the first time Austin had imagined her characters by the sea. In her fourth novel, Emma, fretful Mr. Woodhouse disputes with his elder daughter, Isabella, the pros and cons of two resorts for health and sea bathing, Southend on the Thames estuary and Cromer in Norfolk. Their conversation only serving to make Emma, who has never seen the sea, envious and miserable. In the same novel, Jane Fairfax narrowly escapes drowning at Weymouth, snatched from a watery grave by the prompt action of Mr. Dixon. Louche Brighton is the backdrop for Lydia Bennett's elopement in Pride and Prejudice. In the same novel, a summer visit to Ramsgate almost spells ruin for Georgiana Darcy. In Persuasion, finished only months before Sanditon, the seaside again proves dangerous when Louisa Musgrove's foolish leap from the Cobb at Lyme Regis leaves her concussed. In Persuasion 2, descriptions of the geological upheavals of Dorset's Jurassic coast signal Anne Elliot's emotional reawakening after 8 empty, lovelorn years. If the seaside already represented for Austin a place of romance and potential danger, Sanditon injects something new into the mix. Looking out to sea in 1817 over the untenanted houses and half-finished prospect of her modern resort, Austin, the great realist, appears to question the central impulse of her fiction-making. In Sanditon, the pattern of everyday life is distorted and rearranged. With its cliffs and downs and immense skies, its company of misfits and idlers, and its air of restless anxiety, Sanditon is a new kind of novel. Before Austin, there had been novels set by the sea. Something amounting to a subgenre was gathering momentum in the early decades of the 19th century. Mary Julia Young's A Summer at Brighton of 1807, the anonymous City Nobility or A Summer at Margate of 1808, A Summer by the Sea, also 1807, by Orlando. A mix of sentiment and scandal in fashionable society, these books offered the period's equivalent of beach or holiday reading. With Sanditon, we're in a different literary space altogether. Sanditon begins to mark out something of what the seaside has come to represent in later modern fiction. In works like Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, Penelope Fitzgerald's The Bookshop, John Banville's The Sea, Ian McEwan's On Chesil Beach, and Sarah Perry's recent The Essex Serpent. These novels are not a single type, but what they share is an understanding of sea and shore as a place of longing and change, where we might lose or find ourselves, a place of flux, a place of transformation and transcendence, especially of human reality in the face of nature's great unaccountability. As the term sea change suggests, the effect upon the self is powerful and mysterious. We are none of us the same after a visit to the seaside. Nor are Jane Austen's readers the same after reading Sanditon. Something new has been added. The cover of our new edition signals something of this newness. It's cheeky, an enlarged detail from Thomas Rowlandson's Venus Bathing at Margate from around 1800. An early glimpse into what would, in the Victorian period, become trademark saucy seaside humour. Its comic frankness anticipates the sexiness we knew would inform Andrew Davis's Sanditon-inspired series for Red Planet Pictures and ITV. But I hope it does more than this. the female figure boldly exposed, upended, subverted, no bad image for a less reverent reappraisal of what's new in Austen. Jane Austen, that barbed and critical genius, did not, after all, share our fond obsession with perfection and the safe haven it represents for writing. "Pictures of perfection, as you know, make me sick and wicked," she wrote to her niece Fanny Knight on Sunday, the 23rd of March, 1817, just 5 days after dating the last page of Sanditon.